the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Paula Rabinowitz is my guest. Her books include Black and White and Noir, America's Pulp Modernism, and she's the co-editor of Habits of Being, a four-volume series on clothing and identity. Her new book is American Pulp, How Paperbacks Brought Modernism to Main Street. And now she's here for a complete and unabridged, unexpurgated conversation. Paula Rabinowitz, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. I'm happy to be there, or here, on the shelf.
Well, Dr. Rabinowitz, your first name is Paula. Should we read anything into that?
Well, I discovered, as I was doing research for this book, that yes, you should. I did not know this. I always hated my name. My mother loved it. But I discovered in the many investigations I did into various of levels of pulp that I'm interested in, from high modernism to, trashy whatever, that the name Paula has a great deal of significance in the realm of lesbian pulp novels. And I don't quite understand why, although I have a theory. Obviously it's a feminized masculine name.
Right.
It's Paul, so it's about having a revelation about yourself somehow. He fell off, he had it on the way to Damascus. Somebody else might have had it on the way to the Greenwich Village.
If a character's named Paula, then she's a lesbian.
Well, not only the characters. Sometimes it's the author.
Oh.
But something about the name seems to be more frequent than, say, Carla or Georgia or any of the other feminized masculine names. And my crazy theory about why is the following.
Yes.
Margaret Mead's coming of age in Samoa, which was a Signet Classic mentor book in 1949 and went through dozens and dozens of reprints as a paperback, one of the most popular of their, into the millions of copies sold, and which I have my mother's copy, so I know that she bought it around the time I was born in the early 50s, had in the back of its book the list of the informants, native informants, literally native informants in Samoa, who spoke with her, and there were a number of teenage girls. Of the 17 of them, three had the following names, either Paula, P-A-L-A, Pola, P-O-L-A, or Pula, P-U-L-A. And, of course, that is a book that was instrumental in arguing for a freeing up of sexual repression in the United States so that teenagers could, at this moment, stop worrying about unwanted pregnancies and perhaps enjoy their sexuality a bit more, as the Samoan girls were. And so I don't know if there's some complicated connection between masculinity, femininity, and the idea that there's a kind of more open sexuality available to you with the name Paula, but anyway, that's my name. Whether my mother was aware of this at all, I have no idea.
She had the book. She did have the book. Well, seriously, I thought about asking you, what isn't your book about? I mean, there are so many ways that
exactly
paperback books have affected our society and culture. Do you think that the paperback book had a greater impact than, say, television?
Well, actually, Consumer Reports thought so. In 1986, and their 50th anniversary, they listed the 50 most important goods and services of the 20th century. And, of course, it was 1986, so they hadn't yet gotten to the Internet. And paperbacks were number 4, television number 6. So they thought it was more important. And I have an argument for why one might argue that they are more important, which has to do with the fact that they are tangible things that you can carry with you, so that while television obviously entered people's homes after the Second World War and remade our understanding of politics and culture and consumerism. You owned the television set, and it was a big clunky, you know, RCA piece of furniture, but you didn't own the content. And what is unique about the paperback book, unlike every other form of mass media, radio or movies, is that you owned everything. You had the artwork on the cover, you had the content inside, you had the picture of the author on the back. So it's what I call a total package, and it was the really the only form of mass culture that let you take it home with you and keep it, so that you had the thing as well as all the content that was inside of it.
And of course, today, pretty much, that's the opposite. That is, nowadays, you do have your television in your pocket, and you can own everything. And, you know, so much content is available. In fact, so much content is available that, I don't know, do you think people will stop reading? I mean,
I don't think they just had the AWP meeting here in Minneapolis this weekend. 12,000 writers were here, hundreds and hundreds of readings that were just filled with all kinds of people coming to hear them, and you know, thousands of books for sale. I don't know, books seem to be proliferating, even as, you know, every day we declare the death of reading and literature. So it's a crazy kind of contradiction between this immersive visual culture that we live in, and some kind of, I think, deep desire still for something else than in the form of the tactile quality of holding a book that, you know, you can't get from holding an iPhone.
Well, obviously my show is about books and bookshelves and stuff, so I love books. But, you know, to me, books are like records. They're like an artifact of a period in our history, or a personal history, like the books you saw on your parents' shelves, the books we passed around that were creased open to a good part.
Yep, yeah. Exactly.
So I personally don't think that'll ever die. But I like to look at books. You know, I have lots and lots of books that I've never read. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's probably true for lots of people. I mean,
my students come into my office, which is completely, you know, overflowing with books, and say, oh, have you read all these? That's always the first question. And I say, no, of course not. And Walter Benjamin has a wonderful, wonderful line in his wonderful essay collecting, Unpacking My Library, about why it is that you never want to read all your books. That otherwise, you know, there's no purpose to wake up in the next morning, you know. you need desire to keep you going, which is, oh yes, today I will finally read volume 6 of, you know, Proust, which I have never been able to get to.
Someone said buying a book is buying the time that you plan to spend reading it somewhere in your future.
Ooh, I had never thought about that, but yes, that's true. That is, it's saying that you're gonna close yourself up somehow with that book and have an intimate connection with it. And that is something that I found in doing the research for my book, because I spent a lot of time in the archives of both the writers and the publishers, and there were people who would write these incredibly moving letters about their encounters with these books and what it meant to do something like stay up all night and read someone's book straight through that they had picked up, you know, in a candy store in the afternoon, and writing to the publishers and saying, oh, you know, you need to do more books like this. So, you know, it does sort of spur a kind of intimacy with time and with the possibility of the other, the person who wrote the book, the person who put out the book, the person who might also read it elsewhere and, you know, have the same sort of experience.
Your book made me laugh so loud in the scene. I should say it's a scene, even though it's a nonfiction book. But, you know, when you're doing your research, it reminded me of the reporter in Citizen Kane who's going to go and just, he's only allowed to look at the Thatcher thing. And you're in your library and they bring you this hardcore pornographic book that you're reading.
Oh, yes. And the president of the university was taking people on a tour when I did it.
It's perfect. Here's Dr. Rabinowitz researching gay porn.
Yes, exactly. That we owned in our library, and kept we keep it in the archives here are in these limestone caves in the banks of the Mississippi River.
Wow.
Because they're the perfect temperature. So they're kept like the 100, like the 400-year-old maps of America. So
well, I want to ask you a question about censorship. You know, I'm trying to find the best way of asking it. Do you think that censors were always on the things that we wanted? You know, they didn't like rock and roll. They didn't like comic books, as you point out in your book. They didn't like Lenny Bruce, and they didn't like pornography and literature. But do you think maybe there was a grain of sense in what they were doing? I mean, nowadays, for instance, kids who are 12 years old curse like Lenny Bruce as they're walking around in school. All of their fears have come to pass. You can do a Google search for anything, and porn will pop up on your computer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously, I am totally against censorship, but on the, you know, in terms of the idea of trying to shut down ideas or information or words or knowledge from people. And there's huge amounts of research going on now about the kind of productive qualities of censorship, and that in fact the very act of censuring something or censoring something helps bring it to the fore and turn it into an object of conversation or a subject of conversation that's somehow impinging on various kinds of communities and cultures. So in some ways, censors have this strange phenomenon where they actually help circulate the work.
That's right.
You know,
banned in Boston, the book that New York wouldn't let you read.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it lets people know that they should definitely go after this and that they might want to read it.
Mm-hmm.
There's two levels of censorship. There's the sort of, I guess, censorship that you could speak of that publishing itself is, because now, of course, anybody can self-publish. But these books were vetted heavily by editors as legitimate objects that might, in this case, sell about 100 to 150,000 copies minimum. So they were interested in works that would have popularity, but they also had a sense of their role as cultural arbiters. So, for instance, when I was reading the archives of the New American Library, I came across this one letter that was written by one of the editors to another editor about how this book that they were looking at, which was a kind of novel or sort of memoiristic novel about the world of ballet, was filled with all kinds of homophobic cliches. And this is in the 1940s, which she said, this is not the kind of book we publish. We don't, subscribe to these ideas, and we don't want to perpetuate them. So that's a form of censorship in the sense of deciding that this, was really an inappropriately homophobic book, which during a period when culture itself was extremely homophobic, and that they didn't want to perpetuate this kind of sensibility. That's the kind of good censorship that publishing performs, in that it vets information and tries to steer it towards readers. And then, of course, there's the repressive one on the form of the, perpetuated by the state or by the church. And, those are usually to try and control who has access to what information. And over the long course of the history of modern censorship, it's always been about keeping reading materials or other visual materials out of the hands of young people, poor people, working class people, and various other marginalized people within the dominant culture. And that goes back to the 1868 Hicklin v. Regina case in Britain, which is really the basis of most censorship in the Anglophone world. And that was all about, would you want your servants to be reading this book? Would you want your wife to be reading this book? Would you want your child to read this book?
Right.
You can read it. You're
smart.
You're an enlightened man. But do you want them to read it? You're an educated, enlightened, and wealthy man, but these other people should not have access to it. So that was always the sort of argument about censorship. It's that it's It's not that everything, it's not that it matters really that it exists. It matters who is going to see it. And, you know, the problem is things get out anyway. So if that wealthy guy had it on a shelf, his servant might have pulled it off and read it while she was dusting. So, you know, it's going to be seen. So I am all about, you know, free access to everything, and it opens up conversations, and which maybe are about, no, it's not appropriate to, you know, be Lenny Bruce in the hallways of your high school. Unless you are Lenny Bruce.
That's right. You never know, I guess, who the next Lenny Bruce might be.
Exactly.
we're talking with Paula Rabinowitz, and her new book is called American Pulp: How Paperbacks Brought Modernism to Main Street. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. How do you think the paperback book impacted the civil rights movement or the gay and lesbian rights movement?
Oh, there is no question that paperbacks were instrumental in well, let's talk about lesbians first. Lesbians and gay men as well. But lesbians particularly, because gay men had access to a kind of public space in, you know, say post-war America, as, you know, in port cities, you know, people left the army or the navy, they didn't go back home to their small town, they stayed in New York, they stayed in L.A., they stayed in San Francisco, and there was a kind of development of a much more visible gay culture, but this was not as obvious for lesbians. And one of the things that I found in doing research and the sort of phenomena of lesbian pulp, particularly, was the ways in which it served as a kind of, I guess, sort of like transit vehicle for people to come to recognize their own identities. And I actually talk about it in terms of how-to books. It's sort of how to dress as a lesbian, how to talk as a lesbian, where to go to find other women who might also desire women. So that these books served as a kind of catalyst for certain identities. And then, then speaking about particularly the African-American civil rights movements, a publisher like New American Library, whose editor, Victor Waybright, had been part of Servigraphic, which had been an early civil rights magazine that sort of grew out of the Harlem Renaissance, he was committed to publishing African-American writers. He recruited writers by saying, we're committed to, you know, we've published already Richard Wright, you know, whoever, and we want you to be one of our authors. And they were committed to distributing their books in across the whole United States so that they did not recognize sort of Jim Crow South and the sensibilities that might say, oh, well, we really don't want to, you know, sell Richard Wright. Richard Wright's not going to sell in Alabama. So, and they said, no, you know, if you take our books, you have to distribute them everywhere. So again, they were bringing black authors to visibility in, you know, obviously a majority white America, and giving them the same shelf space and the same look on the cover and the same build-up as you know, Faulkner or Henry James or any other, you know, canonical American white writers, or European writers, for that matter.
And often in terms of the lesbian fiction, there were pen names used. And there's always pen names, right, in all kinds of American pulp. And
yes,
you talk a little bit about why an author would want to do that.
Well, there are many complicated reasons. One might be that you've written some, you know, rather standard, you know, a sort of literary work of fiction, but you're also writing mystery novels on the side, and you don't want your audiences necessarily to know that you're doing that. Others might be, say, for instance, Len Zinberg, who was a Communist Party member and who was blacklisted, so he wrote pulp novels under the name Ed Lacey, just so he could get his stuff out there, because he'd had, you know, problems during the McCarthy period. Other people did it because this way they could publish lots and lots of books, and it looked like they were actually the one writer, but it looked like there were many, many people who were producing this work within the same orbit of the publisher. So there were a whole lot of different reasons.
We've got a huge stable of authors. It's really, it's just one guy. With a
exactly. And so there were many, many different reasons why people decided to do these things. And, you know, it's, and sometimes you'd find that the publishers would suggest to people, you know, why don't you change your name to blah, blah, blah? You know, we think this name will, you know, will go well with what you're writing. And similarly, that happened with titles as well. They often had whole backlog lists of titles that they felt would be more, well, I guess sexy. It wasn't just for lesbian novels necessarily. It was for anything. And then they would sort of run them by and say, what do you think about this, and this?
It's also true that the covers were sometimes false advertising.
Well, yes and no. I mean, the covers were, because of the 1933 Ulysses case, the censorship case, where, you know, which determined that as long as a work of literature had redeeming, you know, social value or had redeeming aesthetic value, and needed to be looked at as a whole work, you couldn't extract one phrase or one word and say, oh, see, this is obscene. After the 1933 case, which allowed Ulysses to be published in the United States, the idea of the whole work really got taken up with a vengeance by these publishers, because their feeling was, we will put on the cover something that is in the book. And so a very good paperback illustrator would be able to, and they were doing, you know, 3 to 5 of these a month, they'd read the book, they would find, no matter what this book was about, the one scene in there where they could manage to have a woman in a pink sweater, it was always a pink sweater that was partially unbuttoned, and it was relevant to something that was in the book. So they were dishonest in one way, but they... But in order to make sure that they, that is the publishers, to make sure that they were not subject to the possibility of censorship under the Ulysses case, always made sure to
it had to link be somewhere to in the, somewhere in the book. She's wearing a
pink sweater. So yeah, the really good illustrators were excellent at finding a scene and extrapolating from that scene. And so that's why you have this sort of sense of uniformity amongst the covers, because pink, you know, a pink sweater, for instance, like I said, for some reason, pink sweaters were signifiers of salacious immoral something. you need to have a woman in there, but, you know, she doesn't necessarily have to have an unbuttoned pink sweater, but why not, you know?
Sure.
She's, you know, there's a scene where she's waking up, or there's, you know, something.
That's right.
Or there's a scene where she's in the kitchen washing dishes, and she just happened to have forgotten to button her sweater. So it's interesting how you see both that these are kind of false advertising on one level, because they all sort of look the same, no matter who's the author and what the book's about. But on another level, they're not. I mean, they really, the publishers were careful to have their illustrators mark some part of the book, some scene in the book.
Well, Paula Rabinowitz, in your book you use the phrase promiscuous reading. And we think of promiscuous as being immoral, but we think of reading as being a high-minded intellectual pursuit.
Mm-hmm. Well, by promiscuous I mean that people are... And yes, that's, I mean, I first of all, I'm interested in that sort of oxymoron there that, you know, we think of reading as good, although reading has not always been thought of as good. It depends on what you're reading. And in the 19th century, you know, it was scandalous that women were reading so many novels. It looked like, you know, the assumption was that this was, you know, kind of lead to the decline and fall of Western civilization. In the 1950s, it was people reading comic books or these pulpy novels, or even not pulpy, but paperback novels and paperback literature as well. Reading has not always been seen as high-minded. It depends on what you're reading and who says it's okay to read, which goes back to the questions of censorship. But what I mean by promiscuous reading is that people read these books indiscriminately, and that to me is very exciting. So that, and just, you know, as I was just saying in terms of the illustrations on the covers, so that people picked up a book, they thought maybe they were getting some sleazy, salacious book about who knows what. But it turned out they were reading a Faulkner novel, because it looked just like that sleazy, salacious book that they had picked up the week before, by Don Kingerly in Swamp Fever, because it had the same kind of cover. So that's part of what I'm interested in. Similarly, works by, you know, that we think of as canonical works of literature might have looked as to be works for, you know, child readers. So there was a kind of, people were reading outside and beyond their levels, if you will, their intellectual levels, their age levels, their education levels, and that to me is a phenomenally exciting kind of democratizing aspect of the paperback, that people had encounters with books that they wouldn't normally have had because of the uniformity of the way these books looked, so that they looked the same, so there was no way to differentiate what they were about. So you just kind of went by the cover, or you went by, oh, I know I like the books by this publisher that have the red edging as opposed to the ones that have the yellow edging, so I think I'll take this one.
In my own personal paperback book collection, I always want them to be pristine, you know, copies. Mm-hmm. But you like to have them all red and bent up and warped.
Oh, yes. No, in fact, the illustrations in my book are all from my collection of books. And, you know, they have Photoshop now. They could have cleaned them all up. And I said, no, I want the creases in there. I want the ripped plastic, you know, cellophane that's peeling up on there. I want the edge of the dog-eared edge in there, because to me this is part of the, I don't know, it's the tactile human quality that says that someone actually read this book. They probably dropped it six times, they spilled coffee on it, it was stuffed into their purse or their pocket and got raggedy and carried around a lot and passed around. And so it has the sort of traces and residues of human experience and human use. You know, it's sort of similar to people who haunt used clothing stores and so forth, because they actually want, not that they need to buy cheap clothes. It's not always economic. It's also sometimes because there's something about wearing something that you know someone else has had on. And so there's a kind of sense of, I don't know, the collectivity of the act of reading.
A connection, a time machine, sort of.
Yeah.
Back to when someone was carrying this book around. Well, your book is amazingly fascinating, and it's called American Pulp, How Paperbacks Brought Modernism to Main Street. And listeners, we haven't talked about the book hardly at all, even though we've been talking for half an hour. You guys have got to read this book. It's a great book. New Yorker magazine went crazy for your book.
Yes, it was very thrilling to have Louis Menand write many, many pages about it.
The whole issue, practically. Well, Dr. Rabinowitz, thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary. It was a pleasure.
That's all the time we have for From the Bookshelf this week. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Paula Rabinowitz. Her new book, American Pulp, How Paperback Brought Modernism to Main Street. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.